Hello, welcome to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Thursday, February 20th, 2025. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We begin the second hour by reading the obituaries. Today's list includes just two names: Donald Charles Kaiser, 90, of Yakima, Washington, and Julie Walters, 43, of Irvine, California. Sun Sounds of Arizona extends its condolences to the families and friends of the people listed in today's obituaries. And now we'll turn to the business section of the paper. It looks like there's three articles in this page. The first one, AZ Electric truck maker Nikola files for bankruptcy. This was written by Russ Wiles for the Arizona Republic. Nikola Corporation, or you might pronounce it Nikola Corporation, the once promising maker of zero emissions heavy trucks and related green technology, filed for bankruptcy protection from creditors on Wednesday. The company seeks ways to improve its balance sheet and trim its debts and to wind down its operations in an orderly manner. Nikola said that it faced macroeconomic and market headwinds. President Donald Trump ordered the federal government, quote, to eliminate the electric vehicle mandate and promote true consumer choice on his first day in office. But Nikola had already announced layoffs as early as 2023 and huge losses last year. The Phoenix company, with a headquarters building south of Sky Harbor International Airport and a gleaming truck manufacturing complex in Coolidge, said that it filed for protection under Chapter 11 of the Federal Bankruptcy Code and filed a motion seeking authorization to pursue an auction and sale process under that code. Nikola said it also filed other customary motions with the U.S. Bankruptcy Court in Delaware to ensure that its limited operations are able to continue, including authorization to meet its obligations to employees during the sale process. In its bankruptcy filing announcement, the company said it intends to continue certain service and support operations for its battery electric and hydrogen-powered trucks currently in the field, including fueling operations through the end of March. After that, the company will need one or more partners to support such activities. Nikola enters Chapter 11 with roughly $47 million in cash on hand to fund these operations and exit Chapter 11. Steve Gursky, who is the company's president and CEO, said in a prepared statement, quote, "With the dedication of our employees and support from our partners, Nikola has taken significant steps to move zero-emission transportation forward," unquote. And that has included bringing its hydrogen fuel cell electric trucks to market and developing hydrogen refueling operations. Nikola's customers have driven its trucks more than 3.3 million miles, and the company's fueling network has dispensed more than 330 million metric tons of hydrogen, he said. However, quote, "like other companies in the electric vehicle industry, we have faced various market and macroeconomic factors that have impacted our ability to operate," unquote. Now, Nikola's fueling network links Northern and Southern California. Along with a likely curtailment of federal subsidies for emissions-free trucks, Nikola has faced an array of other challenges. The company's cash assets have dwindled from $465 million as recently as September 2023. Also, the company posted a loss of $481 million on revenue and $64 million over the 9 months ending September 30th of last year, as its stock price tumbled below a dollar a share from roughly $30 a share last April. Now, Nikola employed around 1,500 people at the end of 2022. That dropped to 870 by the end of 2023, with reports of further layoffs last year. In recent months, the company has taken numerous actions to raise capital, reduce our liabilities, clean up our balance sheet, and preserve cash to sustain our operations. That's a quote from Gursky, the CEO. He went on and said, "Unfortunately, our very best efforts have not been enough to overcome these significant challenges, and the board has determined that Chapter 11 represents the best possible path forward under the circumstances for the company and its stakeholders." Nikola and its advisors have determined that a structured sale process represents the best solution to maximize the value of its assets. Nikola intends to market all or a portion of its assets as part of an orderly winding down of its business. The company is seeking court approval to allow interested parties to submit binding offers to acquire its assets or to be purchased free and clear of its indebtedness. Nikola was founded by Trevor Milton, a college dropout visionary who was once worth more than $6 billion. But he was convicted and sentenced to 4 years in prison for securities and wire fraud. And that was Russ Weil's article, AZ Electric Truck Maker Nikola Files for Bankruptcy. Our second article is entitled, Ford Cuts Manager Stock Bonuses. This is by Nora Eckert for the Reuters News Organization out of Detroit. About half of the middle managers at Ford Motor will not get stock bonuses this year in what is seen internally as CEO Jim Farley's latest attempt to cut the automaker's bloated cost. That's according to six people familiar with the matter. The stock awards are usually paid in March, but senior managers have been told to select which half of their middle management staff will receive them. That's according to four of the sources. Ford said the change was meant to incentivize an improvement in employee performance. A Ford spokesperson said, quote, "We are focused on driving a high-performance culture that recognizes and rewards employees for their business contributions," unquote. The Dearborn, Michigan automaker has struggled with inefficient operations within both its cash-burning electric vehicle division and its fuel-powered vehicle business. Farley has for years told employees and Wall Street that Ford is undergoing a fundamental transformation to become leaner and more competitive as it races against U.S. rivals as well as Chinese automakers and EV producer Tesla. Ford's stock slipped about 23% over the past year, while Detroit rival General Motors shares rose around 23% on the strength of lower cost and higher profits. The automaker and its competitors are also navigating the uncertainty of President Donald Trump's trade policies, which Farley said have added, quote, "a lot of cost and a lot of chaos," unquote. Ford's rivals are more exposed to tariffs on Mexico and Canada, which are scheduled to begin March 1st, but the company could still be hit by 25% duties on vehicles shipped from Mexico, including its Mustang Mach-E, its Bronco Sport, and its Maverick pickup. Employees were informed of the stock award changes in a company briefing last week and told the rationale for slashing bonuses was performance-based. Some Ford workers viewed the move as a way for the automaker to slim its ranks and said they were looking for job openings at other companies. David Whiston, an analyst for Morningstar, said in this email, quote, "With continued profit underperformance versus GM, Farley probably does not want to say the status quo of continued stock awards for all managers is acceptable," unquote. Stock grant bonuses have typically been regarded as a way to retain talent at the automaker, which Farley recently said was key to its competitiveness. The awards vest over 3 years. The stock awards are part of a larger performance-based compensation system, which also includes cash awards. The bonuses are granted to salaried employees company-wide. Most of them are managers. And that was the article, Ford Cuts Manager Stock Bonuses. The third article from the business section, also from the Reuters News Organization, is entitled, New tariffs would test Europe's luxury sector. This was written by Tassilo Hummel and Mimosa Spencer. It comes from Paris. European luxury goods makers say they could draw on pricing power to offset the cost of any tariffs imposed by U.S. President Donald Trump. But analysts say that some brands may have limited room to hike their prices. Famous brands like LVMH's Louis Vuitton or Kering's Gucci are counting on a buoyant U.S. market this year as China lags. However, Trump has threatened new tariffs on the European Union due to trade surpluses that it had with the United States, in a widening offensive that economists say could trigger a global economic slowdown. Executives at Hermes and Kering, which make handbags and loafers that sell for thousands of dollars, said last week they could leverage their brand's cachet to absorb any additional duties. Hermes Executive Chairman Axel Dumas said on Friday, quote, if duties increase, we will increase our prices accordingly, unquote. Kering CEO François-Henri Pinault signaled the same commitment earlier in the week, saying that his brands, which include Gucci, Balenciaga, and Yves Saint Laurent, would, quote, review their pricing strategy, unquote, in the event of tariffs. And then he went on and said, quote, we know how to maneuver that, unquote. Yet, years of aggressive price hikes, particularly during the post-pandemic boom, could make it harder for some brands to pass on the higher import cost. Most brands lifted prices by their most ever in recent years, according to analysts from firms which include UBS, Citi, and Bernstein. Chanel's classic quilted flap bag has more than tripled in price since 2010, while the Lady Dior bag and the Louis Vuitton Keep All travel bag have more than doubled, according to UBS. HSBC analyst Erwin Ramberg said, quote, we've talked a lot about greedflation for the past 12 months, the idea that you've gone too far, too high, too quickly. And at the end of the day, you have basically cut yourself off from that aspirational consumer, unquote. A significant price rise would counter a recent trend for more cautious pricing policy, especially in the U.S. market. Dior, for example, kept U.S. prices flat last year, while Louis Vuitton increased them by a little more than 2%, according to the Paris-based market intelligence firm Data and Data, which monitors online retail prices for brand catalogs. Chanel raised prices by 5.4%, a moderate move compared with previous years, while jewelers like Tiffany and Richemont owned Cartier and Van Cleef & Arpels slowed the pace of U.S. increases to 4% to 6%. That's down from over 8% in the previous year. Data and Data CEO Zuhair Ghidi said, quote, I think that the major brands' room for maneuver in terms of price increases in the United States will be fairly limited in 2025, unquote. He then went on and said this would risk accentuating price differences between different regions and jeopardize costly efforts undertaken over the years to harmonize prices on a global scale. Well, Morningstar analyst said in a recent note, quote, a 10 to 20% tariff on European luxury goods could depress luxury sales in the United States, especially for companies like Burberry and Kering that focus more on an affluent and aspirational clientele as opposed to the ultra-rich patrons, unquote. Now, as Chinese demand stays subdued, Europe's luxury companies are pinning their hopes on Americans in 2025, boosted by roaring equities and crypto markets. Even though business with American customers is expected to grow fast this year at about 6%, buoyed also by a strong dollar, sales to Chinese customers are set to drop 1%. But the outlook does remain uncertain. U.S. consumer sentiment dropped unexpectedly in February to a 7-month low, and inflation expectations rocketed as households feared they would pay the price for Trump's trade policies. Analysts at Citi noted spending habits of aspirational shoppers, those are consumers who stretch their budgets seeking to elevate their social status, well, those spending habits remain choppy. Hermes CEO Dumas last week said he still saw the United States as a land of conquest to generate growth, pointing to his group's retail expansion into second-tier U.S. cities, with upcoming openings in Phoenix and Nashville. LVMH hinted that it could further bulk up production there. CEO Bernard Arnault and his family have cultivated personal ties with Trump, with four of them attending the president's inauguration last month. Analyst at HSBC said, quote, "We believe the group is positioning itself to be able to negotiate with the U.S. administration on potential tariffs by offering to produce more in the United States, as is already the case for Louis Vuitton, and could easily be done for other brands," unquote. So asked how he viewed lobbying efforts from Arnault in the United States, Kering owner Pinault told Reuters, quote, "It's certainly a good thing," unquote, "if it helps the European luxury sector avoid additional duties. However, like some other European luxury executives, Pinault ruled out any shifts of production to the U.S., saying that could dilute his group's made-in-Europe image, and that would make no sense. And that was the article, New Tariffs Would Test Europe's Luxury Sector. Well, we're coming up on 17 minutes past the hour. We're going to move on from the business section to the sports section of the paper. On the front page of the sports section, at the top of the page, there's this big picture of a sprinter by the name of Mayan Usoro, where she's sitting on the track field, posing for her portrait during practice at Cesar Chavez High School on Tuesday in Levine. And above her, in the sky above her head, is the title, Focused on the Records. And this article was written by Logan Stanley for the Arizona Republic. Kai Westbrook, Jessica Onyepanuka, Kenyana Wilson. These are some of the most storied names for sprinters in state history. Soon, Levine Cesar Chavez Jr., Mayan Usoro's name could be ahead of them. Usoro is mere milliseconds away from surpassing these athletes and their best times. Onyepanuka, the state record holder in the 100 meters, ran 11.31 seconds while in high school. Usoro is at 11.5 entering her third season. Westbrook, the state record holder in the 200, ran 23.37 seconds, but Usoro is at 23.48 seconds. Both Onyepanuka and Westbrook went on to have successful careers at USC, while Wilson shined at LSU. Usoro said, quote, "I definitely focus on the records, because, as you know, my coach is a record holder, and she wants me to do the same thing as her," unquote. Well, that coach is Eureka Hall, an athlete ahead of her time while competing at Safford in the early 1990s. Hall is a state record holder in the 400 meter at 52.99 seconds. That record was set back in 1992, the third longest standing record on the books, and is still the only time an Arizona athlete has ever run under 53 seconds for that event. Hall ended up competing at LSU, one of the schools that has targeted Usoro in her college recruitment. Fellow SEC schools, Florida and Tennessee, have also been in contact with Usoro. Clemson made an in-home visit recently. Division I schools used to visit Cesar Chavez for football recruits, but they haven't in a while. Now they're back, roaming the halls. Hall said, quote, "We know she's going to have a bright future in this sport. You can just see it. Do I think of her being different than everybody else? Yes. Mayen is special. Not that I treat her differently than anybody else. Everybody's on the same training. However, Mayen has the ability to run so smooth without even having to try hard." Unquote. So entering this spring, Yusoro is ranked in the top 15 in the nation among returners for the 100, where she's ranked 12th, and in the 200 meter, she's ranked 11th. Yusoro ran 7.38 for the 60 meters at an indoor meet in Flagstaff at the end of January, and that time currently is number 8 in the United States. A lot of the athletes on Cesar Chavez's roster come from different clubs around the area, and Yusoro was no different. She comes from Do Right, which happens to be run by the most famous sprinter in state history, Dwayne Evans from Phoenix South Mountain. Evans memorably ran 20.22 seconds in the 200, which was then a national record, and he made the 1976 Montreal Olympics as a 17-year-old, winning the bronze medal. Yusoro, a former soccer and basketball player, now fully focused on track, has been one of the fastest among her peers since starting the sport at 5 years old. Her running mechanics are almost perfectly sound, to the point where it looks effortless. She comes from a family with a background in track and field, with her mother, Udeme, a sprinter at Portland State, and her aunt, Otoro Elijah, a jumper at Washington State. Sprints coach Jamar Howard, a former All-American at LSU, said, quote, "She is a generational talent. Obviously, training matters, but the kind of talent she is, you can't coach that," unquote. With the 100 and 200-meter state records are the focus, Hall even thinks Yusoro can pull off the sprinting triple crown and get the 400-meter as well. And that's the one that Hall owns. Yusoro hasn't put much focus into the event in high school, but has managed to run 56.29 seconds. Hall said, quote, "If anybody I want to beat my record, I want Mayen to beat my record," unquote. And that was the article, Focus on the Records. Our next article is about NFL football, and it's entitled, Cardinals New Offensive Line Coach is No Curmudgeon. This was written by Bob McManaman for the Arizona Republic. He is only 41 years old, but he's been coaching for 18 years at 6 college football programs, and is fresh off winning a national championship as the offensive line coach for the Ohio State Buckeyes. Now, the new offensive line coach for the Arizona Cardinals, Justin Fry, can't wait to show his players what he is all about. He already knows a few of them. He coached left tackle Paris Johnson Jr. at Ohio State when wide receiver Marvin Harrison Jr. played. He also coached backup center John Gaines II at UCLA. As for the rest of Arizona's O linemen, Fry said he will show his true colors right from the start. Quote, "They're going to feel and sense from me that I'm not an old curmudgeon guy that's just going to sit back and yell and do this, and I'm not the new age guru that's got all the answers," unquote. He said this Wednesday during his introductory news conference at the Cardinals' Tempe training facility. He went on and said, "I'm in it with them. That was the way when I was a college coach, and it's going to be the way as a pro coach, because there's a center, 2 guards, and 2 tackles, and all 5 guys have to do their job. And it's my job to make sure I maximize who they are and that we get the right people doing the right jobs," unquote. Fry, a former offensive lineman at Indiana University, is already waist-deep into poring over practice tape and game film since his hiring was announced a week ago. He said, you can spin yourself into a web of watching too much, watching the minutiae or the pebbles, and then the boulder's going to roll your ass over up and down the hill. Fry, who replaces Clayton Adams, who is now the offensive coordinator for the Dallas Cowboys, began his duties with the Cardinals by watching game film from last season first. He studied the flow of each game, how certain players responded after negative plays, and how the O-line rode the wave on positive possessions when one successful drive turned into two or three more. Then he began breaking things down individually, pinpointing every player's particular skill set from a technique perspective. He wrote down three or four things he liked that he hopes to enhance, and three or four things that need to get better, be it in pass protection scheme or run game assignments. But the key, he said, is trying to keep it simple. And when it comes to what type of traits he likes best in alignment, it's these three things. Quote, do they love ball? Can they learn ball? And can they execute what you're asking them to do? Unquote. Fry likes most of what he's seen. Last season, the Cardinals finished 7th overall in rushing offense with 144.2 yards per game, and they allowed the 5th fewest sacks with 30. Fry said the word of the day would probably be excitement. There's an identity here. You clean up some things that weren't good, you scratch what itches, and then you try to enhance and supplement what was really good. Having an identity, that breeds confidence, and confidence breeds success. And you can see that on the tape. The past month since Ohio State beat Notre Dame for the CFP national title has been a whirlwind. Fry described it as a blur. He said, the confetti's falling and you're there celebrating with your guys and all the work and everything you put into it. You get home, you take a breath, and then you keep your kids on the team. The transfer portal, the college free agency, your head is on a swivel all the time. And then you're right on the road recruiting. So the celebration of that was not until the dead week later on, unquote. Well, getting a phone call from Cardinals coach Jonathan Gannon asking him to join his staff in Arizona was, quote, an influx of juice, Fry said. It was also like instant karma. Fry said he could tell this would be a good fit for him simply because of his conversation with Gannon and the alignment and vision the head coach had created entering his third year at the helm. Fry said Johnson Jr., Harrison Jr., and Gaines gave him the scoop on, quote, what the real inner workings were like, unquote, and it made him feel even more comfortable that, quote, the fit was a square peg in a square hole, unquote. Well, despite his vast coaching experience, Fry knows he now is a rookie at the NFL level. But the guy just loves this game, and it has become his life. He said, quote, it's the football component of it. I'm just real excited when the foot hits the ball and it's kicked off. It's ball. It's what everyone strives to do. It's what everyone watches. That's your job. So just being a small part of that, it's going to be fun, unquote. And that was the article by Bob McManaman, Cardinals' new offensive line coach, is no curmudgeon. Well, the third article from the front page of the sports section is a column by Greg Moore, and he's a columnist for the Arizona Republic, and it's entitled, Bidwell Has Two Sides to His Story. Here's what he wrote. Hate him or love him, Michael Bidwell picked up the phone. That's got to count for something these days. Bidwell, who is principal owner and team president of the Arizona Cardinals, has been in the news recently with competing headlines. Michael Bidwell elected to Arizona Sports Hall of Fame. Or, Cards owner sued, accused of unmercifully harassing assistant. Well, which is it? Is he the guy who led the charge to get a first-class football stadium built in Glendale, attracting 3 Super Bowls and 2 men's Final Fours? Or is he the guy accused of bullying and berating a personal assistant almost every day? Bidwell said Wednesday morning in a phone interview with the Arizona Republic, and notice he's not hiding, but this is what he said, quote, "This is not an uncommon experience, particularly in high-profile industries like sports, entertainment, and business." He went on and said, "Allegations can be made, and they get a lot of attention, but they are just that. They're allegations. We strongly deny them. We will strongly defend ourselves against them, and we believe that when the process is complete, the facts will reveal that reality, and that reality is completely different than what is alleged." The lawsuit from Brittany Neuheisel, who worked for Bidwell about 6 years, is not the first to accuse him of bad behavior. A former player personnel executive, Terry McDonough, said Bidwell tried to force him to use burner phones to communicate with a general manager who had been suspended from the team after getting arrested for extreme DUI. The Neuheisel suit is pending. The McDonough suit was dismissed. It's fair if you're confused by it all. I am too. And I've been around Bidwell more times than I can count since I started covering the team back in 2017. He's always been pleasant. He's always answered every question. He's never come across like an entitled billionaire who thinks he's better than everybody by virtue of his wealth. Maybe he's a big phony, but he's never triggered my you-know-what detector. If anything, I've always been surprised that he seemed so much like one of the guys. So, I made it a point to call and talk to him before giving my opinion. And like I said, he could have lawyered up and refused to take my call, but that's not what happened. He picked up the phone and gave me his perspective. And that's got to count for something. At least, it does with me. Bidwell comes across like a guy who understands what comes with his job as one of only 32 owners of an NFL franchise. Bidwell said, quote, "When you're in an industry like sports, there's pressures that come with that. I've been around it for a while, but it's a privilege to be in this position, and I'm fortunate. There are going to be critics, and that just comes with it. It's a competitive industry, fast-paced. You understand that there's going to be some criticism," unquote. Now, with that, it's important to stay grounded. It goes for anyone in the spotlight, from players and coaches to executives and team owners. The more exclusive the club, the more exclusive the company. Prominent people need a good team around to tell them hard truths if necessary. Bidwell said, quote, "I've got a great leadership team here with the Cardinals, other friends and supporters in the community and family, and when I look at what I've got to do, it's complete the task at hand. That's what I get up worrying about every day. What do I need to get done today? And I don't so much worry about some of the critics that may be out there," unquote. Well, he sounds like a ball player, or a stoic there, focus on what you can control and learn to accept the rest. For Bidwell, he's got to put together a playoff team and get ready for a Hall of Fame induction. Bidwell said, quote, "It's a very special moment. I'm joining my father in Arizona Sports Hall of Fame. Pat Tillman, Larry Fitzgerald, Jake Plummer, Adrian Wilson, so many great Cardinals who have done great things with their teammates. It's really an honor, and I accept it on behalf of all the people in the organization and the community. I'm super honored," unquote. Well, he should be, but only sorta. The Arizona Sports Hall of Fame doesn't have a permanent home or display, and that's an issue we'll deal with some other time. But for now, just read over what Bidwell said and decide for yourself whether you love the guy or hate the guy. And that's Greg Moore's article, Bidwell Has Two Sides to His Story. Well, we're about 35 minutes past the hour, so I think we have time for some sports briefs. These are short little paragraphs. First one is Chargers confirmed for NFL sequel in Sao Paulo. Friday Night Lights are coming back to Brazil for the second consecutive season, with the Los Angeles Chargers confirmed for the Week 1 matchup on September 5th in Sao Paulo at Corinthians Arena. The NFL's first regular season game in the South American nation was played at the same venue last season between the Eagles and Packers. The site was used during the 2014 FIFA World Cup and the 2016 Summer Olympic Games, and the league felt it was important to return to the home of what the NFL said is its second largest international fan base after Mexico. Beginning in 2025, the NFL can schedule as many as 8 regular season games internationally. The NFL has confirmed 2 games in London with the Jaguars, part of a third in an annual commitment to play a home game in the UK, while also announcing games in Berlin, Germany, Madrid, Spain, and Dublin, Ireland. During Super Bowl 59 media sessions, the league confirmed the long-swirling rumors that it would play a game in Australia. Now, that game will happen during the 2026 regular season in Melbourne, featuring the other LA team, the Rams. Our next sports brief, 7 charged in thefts of items from athletes' homes. 7 men have been charged with federal crimes in connection with robberies pulled off at the homes of professional athletes. According to a criminal complaint filed in the Middle District of Florida, the men entered the homes of NFL and NBA players and stole items with a total worth of more than $2 million. The U.S. Department of Justice identified the men as natives of Chile, each between the age of 20 and 38, and as members of a South American theft ring. They were charged with conspiracy to commit interstate transportation of stolen property, and the maximum penalty is 10 years in federal prison. Known victims of property theft since last fall include Patrick Mahomes and Travis Kelce of the Kansas City Chiefs, Joe Burrow of the Cincinnati Bengals, and Bobby Portis Jr. of the Milwaukee Bucks. The incidents occurred when the players were known to be at games or out of town. And stolen items included designer watches, jewelry, and at least one firearm, according to the Fox 13 Tampa Bay channel. Federal law enforcement recently released a photo, dated November 2nd, that shows 3 of the men, all of them charged in the complaint, posing with watches and a safe taken from the home of Portis. The following day, Portis said his home had been broken into during the Bucks game against the Cleveland Cavaliers. That was our second sports brief. And the third one is entitled Widow Says Hockey Hall of Famer Bobby Hull Had Stage 2 CTE. Chicago Blackhawks legend and Hockey Hall of Fame member Bobby Hull has been posthumously diagnosed with CTE, the brain disorder linked to repetitive head trauma in contact sports. Hull's widow, Deborah Hull, and Dr. Ann McKee, director of the Boston University CTE Center, confirmed that he had stage 2 of 4 stages of CTE when he died at the age of 84 on January 30th, 2023. And those were some sports briefs. We're coming up on 39 minutes past the hour, so we're going to go see if we can't find an opinion piece to read. And we have one from Lori Roberts entitled, Hobbs Vetoes Republicans' Election Bill, Leaving GOP Delighted. Governor Katie Hobbs on Tuesday vetoed a proposal to speed up election results, and Republicans are outraged, and, I suspect, secretly delighted. Vetoed, the Arizona Republican Party proclaimed, at Governor Hobbs could have done the right thing for Arizona by signing the bill to give our state same-day results. Instead, she showed yet again that she is nothing more than a radical partisan puppet masquerading as a governor. Republicans will remember this action, Governor. Then there was another quote. This was a missed opportunity to increase voter confidence and reduce frustration on election night. That was from Senate President Warren Peterson, a Republican from Gilbert, who echoed that it was also an opportunity for Republicans to slip a political Mickey into the bill. That's one that would have forced the vast majority of Arizona voters to jump through a new hoop to get an early ballot. Hobbs wrote in her veto message, quote, "This legislation effectively ends the active early voting list, something that has nothing to do with faster election results, but disenfranchises voters by adding additional steps for the hundreds of thousands of Arizona voters who prefer to vote by mail," unquote. Make that millions of Arizona voters. It's a disappointing end to a bill that started so well, at least for those who prefer to know who won the election before we sit down to Thanksgiving dinner. Okay, that's a bit of an exaggeration, but only a bit. Arizona has always taken a long time to count votes. We've only noticed recently as races have tightened. The problem is the hundreds of thousands of voters who drop off their early ballots on Election Day. Ballots that can't even begin to be processed until the next day. And thus came Peterson's proposal to cut off early ballot drop-offs on the Friday before the election. Anyone voting after that would have to show ID, allowing their ballots to be tabulated on the spot. And Hobbs and the Democrats, who voters disproportionately drop off their early ballots on Election Day, immediately labeled it a voter suppression bill. Yeah, I didn't buy it either. If you want to vote early, then vote early. You have most of a month to get it done. If you don't want to vote early, you can always do it the old-fashioned way on Election Day. Peterson's bill made sense here in the swing state that was the last to be called in the 2024 presidential election. But then came the House Republicans, loading down his proposal with a plan to make it more difficult to get an early ballot. A plan, by the way, that has absolutely nothing to do with speeding up results. The conspiracy crowd has considered the state's decades-old early ballot program to be a hotbed of fraud ever since their candidates started losing a few years ago. They know they can't eliminate it, given the program's popularity, so instead, they hope to weaken it. Under the bill that was sent to Hobbs, voters in Maricopa and Pima counties would have to request an early ballot every election cycle, confirming their address. Voters in the smaller counties would have to do so every 4 years. No longer would Arizonans who regularly vote automatically get a ballot in the mail. In her veto message, Hobbs laid out several options she was willing to consider in return for an early ballot cutoff, chief among them, same-day voter registration. In her veto message, she wrote, quote, "A negotiated bill that included some of these provisions would have shown Arizonans that it's possible to both speed up counting and expand voter access," unquote. So, same-day voter registration? Yeah, nope, the Republicans were never going to go there. And Hobbs was never going to require early voters to vote early, never mind the popularity of the idea. Republicans hold the upper hand here. They can bypass Hobbs and send their election plan to the 2026 ballot, just as she stands for re-election. In fact, they'll be delighted to do so. A spokesman for the Republican Governors Association said, quote, "Katie Hobbs is failing to sign even the most common-sense bills being placed on her desk. It's pathetic," unquote. And then Maricopa County Recorder Justin Heap groused, quote, "Katie Hobbs doesn't care that Arizonans want election results on election night," unquote. Already the campaign has begun. And that was Lori Roberts' opinion piece, "Hobbs Vetoes Republicans' Election Bill, Leaving the GOP Delighted." And we're coming up on 45 minutes past the hour, so we're going to move on over to the entertainment section, and we will begin by reading today's horoscopes. We will begin with the sign of Aries. That would be birth dates from March 21st, April 19th. Are you feeling compelled to say your piece? Hidden thoughts may blurt out. Think before you speak. For Taurus, birth dates from April 20th to May 20th, What will your dreams cost you? Whether gathering money or doing a value check, push for assessment. For Geminis, birth dates from May 21st to June 21st, you have a grand way of expressing yourself today. Do you have a message for the public? Share before you overthink it. For Cancers, that's birth dates from June 22nd through July 22nd, you are in a philosophical mindset today, but are there definitive conclusions to find? For Leo, birth dates from July 23rd through August 22nd, are you bordering on too much information? A secret or two may come out. Determine where the boundary is. For you fellow Virgos out there with birth dates from August 23rd through September 22nd, professional advancement may be on your mind. Find a confidant to talk it out. For Libras, September 23rd through October 23rd birth dates, are you seeing the forest through the trees? Expand your outlook. Look beyond the immediate. Scorpios, October 24th through November 21st birth dates, are you inspired to take a gamble? The only issue is whether you may be overthinking or not accounting for the consequences. For Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st birth dates, talk out the future of a home situation within a partnership. Do you share the same foundational vision? Capricorns, December 22nd through January 19th birth dates, you're here, you're there, you're everywhere. Mercury, activating Jupiter, can have you running around with no end in sight. Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th birth dates. Your thoughts are on security while your spirit wants to have fun. Is there a strategy to obtain both? And finally, Pisces, birth dates from February 19th to March 20th. Express yourself in a home or family situation. Have something on your mind that you want to discuss? Share your thoughts. And that was the horoscopes for today. We turn now to letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren in her column, Dear Abby. The first letter goes like this. Dear Abby, my 25-year-old niece is getting married in 4 months. 5 years ago, she lost her father in a tragic accident while her parents were on vacation. Since that time, she has come out as gay and grown closer to me than to her mom, my sister. I was always close to my sister and both of her daughters while they were growing up and helped out financially when times were tough. My sister recently remarried and plans to move to another state with her new husband prior to the wedding. My niece has asked me to walk her down the aisle along with my sister. My sister said it's disrespectful to her since she is the mother. I don't want to hurt my sister or my niece. My niece says it's both of us or neither one. There are no grandparents. I told her I want to sit with my husband for the wedding and that her mom should walk her down the aisle. The other bride's parents will be walking their daughter down the aisle. I know it's my niece's wedding and she should have what she wants. But I feel stuck in the middle. Any suggestions? Signed, Torn in Two in Massachusetts. And Abby responds, Dear Torn, I do have one. You have already told your niece you would prefer to sit with your husband rather than cause resentment from your sister. Your niece feels strongly about having you walk with her, and it is her wedding. You might suggest walking her halfway down the aisle and then handing her off to her mother, but leave the final decision where it belongs, which is with the bride. And the next letter goes, Dear Abby, I'm a 19-year-old guy and live with my parents. We have this neighbor, Ed, who until recently was friends with my dad. We've hung out with him several times and have even gone over to each other's houses to watch sports games and eat dinner. The problem is, Ed's become very overbearing and strange. He's always been a little off the wall, which at first we both found hilarious. But since then, his foul language and vulgarities have rubbed us the wrong way. He's disrespectful to his wife and son, which I know isn't my business, but Dad and I are over it. Lately, Ed has been constantly calling and texting my dad. Now he started texting me, asking why my father isn't responding. Now, I don't know how he got my number. Last month, Ed walked into our house through our sliding glass door while I was home alone watching TV. Dad seems to want to just ignore the issue, but I think it's the wrong move. Should I approach this nosy and indignant neighbor, signed Uneasy in Illinois? And Abby responds, "Dear Uneasy, no, you should not. Keep that sliding glass door locked. And if you have receive any more texts from this man, block him. You are not required to discuss your father's or your change in attitude with him." And those letters were written as a response from Dear Abby, which was written by Abigail Van Buren. She's also known as Jean Phillips, and the column was started by her mother, Pauline Phillips. And you can contact her very easily by going to her website, www.dearabby.com. And those were the letters of advice from Abigail Van Buren. Now, I think we have time for taking a look at a few comics. Let's see. First one could be about Blondie, drawn by Dean Young and John Marshall. Uh-oh, Dagwood's in the kitchen, and he's got stuff on the kitchen counter. Oh, he's preparing something. And Blondie comes in and says, "Are you okay, honey?" Dagwood's holding something on his, and he says, oh, just trying to get through Love Your Pet Day." And Blondie says, "Get through it? It's a happy occasion to celebrate Daisy." And Dagwood says, "Oh, I know. It's just that I think she's milking it for all it's worth." And Blondie says, "Don't worry. You'll get your couch back tomorrow." And then on the TV set we hear, "And now back to Lassie." Daisy is laying on the couch. She's wearing a little crown. There are some balloons around the couch. And Dagwood just put two plates of dog food on the coffee table in front of the TV. "I think she's milking it for all it's worth. Don't worry, you'll get your couch back tomorrow." And that was Blondie. Then we have Beetle Bailey, drawn by Greg Bryan and Neil Walker. And the chef is standing in the serving line in the commissary or cafeteria, and there's Private Beetle. He's got his plate in his hand, and he says, "You call this lunch?" And the chef says, "You're going to love it." And the next frame he says, "Compared to what I'm serving for dinner." And that was Beetle Bailey. And then in Zits, drawn by Jerry Scott and Jim Borgman, Jeremy's watching his mom prepare dinner, and he says, "School is too hard." And mom says, "Nothing worth doing is ever easy," said Theodore Roosevelt. And Jeremy goes, "Boring." And in the last frame, he says, "How about some useful advice for a change?" And mom says, without even looking at him, "Get off the kitchen counter." And that was Zits. And in Baby Blues, drawn by Rick Kirkman and Jerry Scott, Zoe and Hammy, the two older siblings, are laying on the floor, and they're coloring. And Hammy looks it over at her and sees that she's coloring, and he says, "No way! Blue is my favorite color, too." And the next frame, he says, "We're more alike than we think." And the last frame, Zoe's sitting in the chair in the living room all by herself, and she looks kind of shocked. And mom comes in and says, "You're depressed about what?" And that was Baby Blues. Then in the Peanuts cartoons, drawn by Charles Schulz. There's Woodstock, the little bird, and he's walking along, and he's holding a helium-filled balloon. And then the balloon, he hops up in the air, and the balloon swings around. And now Woodstock is upside down in the air over Snoopy with the balloon below him. And in the last frame, Snoopy thinks, you know, Woodstock isn't much for doing anything right. And that was Peanuts. And in Pickles, drawn by Brian Kring, Earl says, he's sitting on in his chair reading his newspaper, and he says, your generation is pretty handy with modern technology, to his daughter. And then he says, but my generation can do things yours can't, like cooking from scratch and sewing clothes and canning fruits and vegetables. And she looks at him and says, but you can't do any of those things, Dad. And he looks at her and says in the last frame, well, no, not me personally, but your mom can. And that was Pickles. And the comic strip Dennis the Menace, drawn by Hank Ketchum. Dennis is sitting on the kitchen floor in the Wilson's house, and he's banging on a pot with a couple of wooden spoons, like he's a drummer. And George and Martha are sitting at the table having a cup of coffee. And George says, I know Dennis is acting his age, but I just wish he would do it at home. And that was Dennis the Menace. Well, let's find some celebrities who are celebrating their birthdays today. Happy birthday to Mitch McConnell, the senator from Republican from Kentucky, turns 83 today. Actress Sandy Duncan turns 79. Model Cindy Crawford turns 59. Comedian and TV host Trevor Noah turns 41, and singer Rihanna turns 37. Congratulations and happy birthday. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. You have been listening to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Thursday, February 20th, 2025. Have a great day.